from 5 o'clock, so I'm going to jump the gun again here. Let's call it 5 o'clock, and we'll start the second hour, and I just do it like I normally would. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. If you've been listening, you already know this, but for those of you who just tuned in, we are here located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. For those of you who might have just tuned in, you would have heard in the first hour readings by David Malone, Jason Haru, Allison Chisholm, Michael E. Castiles, and Carolyn Smart from this year's Poets at Art Fest, 4-day poetry festival. Coming up in this hour from that same outdoor 4-day festival, you're going to hear readings by Bruce Cudmore, Mary Lee Bragg, Brendan Wiley, and Colin Morton. And top of the hour thing I do each hour of the show is mention that occasionally some poetry, music, or spoken word on this show may contain strong language. I do try to preserve that as much as I can to honor the creative integrity of the work and the poet and the writer or composer themselves. And so we've got a pretty tight hour again this hour, but I will mention again in case you did just tune in, I will at the end of this hour as well, but just in case, just so you know, if you missed the first hour, you'll still be able to find that because I do upload both hours of my show each week to my personal blog space for the show. I did mention this just now, but again, this is for those of you that might have just tuned in and didn't know. So you can find them there later this evening after I get them uploaded at Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com. So I'll tell you what. Let's go ahead and just move into this second session of readings. Again, you are going to hear readings by Bruce Cudmore, Mary Lee Bragg, Brendan Wiley, and Colin Morton. And get it all set up, and I think we're good to go. Here we go. Today. It's been a lot of fun. It really has. Today in this session, you're going to hear readings by Bruce Cudmore, Mary Lee Bragg, Brendan Wiley, and Colin Martin. Morton. Why did I say Martin? Yeah, there probably is. Yeah, I bet there's another Colin Morton as well, too. Anyway, it's going to be a wonderful session. Thank all of you for coming out. And up first, Bruce Cudmore is a 43-year-old father of four. He says, "My wife Kelly and I moved to the Thousand Islands area from Toronto about 13 years ago. We both work and our kids have many interests, so we have a busy house. I became interested in poetry in January 2021. My first poem started as a bullet point list meant to describe a beautiful winter scene that had noticeably lifted me out of a bad mood. The list of observations spontaneously became poetic expression. Since then, as time permits, I've been writing and reading poet intentionally. I have much to learn. Let's bring up Bruce."
Thanks again, Bruce, for organizing everything. This has been a real joy. So I've got about 20 poems. No, just kidding. I do have about 8. They're short poems, and I tend to do nature poetry. I'm going to start with 3 kind of, I guess I'd call them devotional poems. This one's called A Liturgy. A soft cloud of small brown fluttering moths glimmers in place, backlit by a midsummer setting sun beneath an elm's canopy. They breathe out their life cycle like incense. Above them, a cicada sings worship during its long-awaited brief apex. Hidden below them, ants recite proverbs. I'm ushered into a living temple. Second devotional poem, The Psalter of Your Heart. Take a quiet pause every day to consider the psalter that is your heart. Lines written in moments through time, not only in poems like David's, each of them useful and poignant, common and unique, sacred, moving toward some kind of fulfillment, and eventually sung as hymns. All right. Okay, another short devotional poem called A Meditation. The soft quiet of meditation becomes a hum of communion with the wisdom in things. And we become enwombed and bear visions. Wisdom is always that way, born with an E. We're embodied offspring of wisdom, or Sophia. And when we crown, then breach the vibrant hum to re-enter the quiet, then raucous, we remain meditated upon by Sophia. Okay, as Bruce said, I've got a bunch of kids, and so I've got a few poems having to do with them. So here's the first one. It's called After Day Camp. This instance rolls to a stop, steps up and out of time to become a few seconds of my day that touch importance. A pause to watch glimpses of t-shirts bathed in late summer, late afternoon sun, and the bob of bright hats moving in and out of view. I pause to listen to muted calls of middle distance voices carried away by the wind to the heart of a place that collects every ounce of joy. That poem was inspired before they got in the car after day camp. And this is, so I've got a few poems today that are new. I'm trying them out, written within the last week or so. And this one's called Shadow Selves. One thin stem of wood sorrel with three tender hearts on top casts its shadow on a rock. The rock presents its brief history accurately by the available material, so both stems stand together as sentinels in their respective realms. This has meaning I want in a photograph. My young daughter marvels at how long her shadow is in the evening green grass, and she walks it to mine. Casting her arm around my waist, we look at our statures together, jiggle for jiggle, twitch for twitch. I want to draw this, she says. All right, here's a poem based on a dream. This is also a new poem, so bear with me. I think it's about trying to be a good parent and make connections with kids in a busy world, but I'm not sure if I had to psychoanalyze it. I don't really know. Let you do that. It's called The Wolf Trot. I was searching for my daughter in a familiar wood. She wasn't lost or not long out of sight when I came pushing past pine boughs into a small clearing and a black wolf trotted close. I faked big, quick, and instinctively locked eyes. It stopped and licked its chops. No growl and no dripping fang. Curious, this fairy tale search for my child in a troublesome world that is possible to trot playfully. Now got a couple of poems on suffering. That transition isn't meant to be associated with having kids, but that's where we are. And actually, this poem that I'm going to read is my first one to be published in the winter 2025 issue of Devour, Art and Lit Canada. The poem is called Suffering, and there's often times in the poem where I describe the visual and auditory structure of the word rather than its meaning. And so when that's the case, I think I'll just use quotation marks to signify that, see if it works. Anyways, suffering. The soft consonants of the English word suffering gently convey heavy meaning, leveling human differences as sanding smooth surfaces. A sufferer feels alone and hears, along with others, how suffer asks to be whispered, then sounds like silent, nose-breathed sobs, a verb that allows rather than acts. Visually, suffer uses the sea and will have the foamy rolling breakers in its swelling middle wash over the subject of the sentence. Suffering asks to be solved and healed. The suffering asks for the salve of being held. See how suffering ends with the singing ring of a gladly rung bell. I did add a verse since it was published, so sorry about that. This one's called The Screaming Scribe. Seated in the public library, I was reading when I heard the loud and repeated screams of a person in distress. I folded the prose. I cannot guess her particular pain, but as she's escorted out the door, I feel her anguish pales the human travail of suffering that scribes itself into all lives. The soundless books surrounding me suggest if their pages could speak, they would utter their written cries right beside her. Through the screens, I hear her on the streets, and the city's stacked stories echo her voice. I've got a couple more poems, two more, and they're more on the lighthearted side of things. This again is a new one, written within the last week or so. It's called The Way of a Seed. Plants conjured up fascinating ways to proliferate. They got the idea for a seed and its prodigal pollination. They pegged our ancient weakness for flowers and fruit. Then, from their stationary posts, sent seeds by wind and wing or digestion or propulsion, like the orange jewelweed, springing at the slightest touch to the jumping delight of children. Then, at an outpost clung, claiming their piece of earth as flags. Perhaps a most prolific increase happens when a seed is sown on the tongue and in the belly of humankind, who, implanted by its desire, lets the seed drop, thoroughly lodged in the mind, where vast fields of wheat sprout, sway, and feed nations. And here I am, walking around covered in burrs. Here's the last one. It's a short poem, and it's kind of a reminder that despite all the tough things that happen in life and in the world, we're capable of a lot of good too. So it's called Measuring the Human Heart. There is a depth to the word grace, a volume. Off soundings, it can't be fathomed, only swum or drunk. And rippling on the surface, it fills the human heart. Thank you.
Up next, Mary Lee Bragg. Grew up in Calgary, but has lived in Ottawa for many years. Her poetry and short fiction have been published in literary magazines and e-zines in Canada, the U.S., and Cuba. Her poetry chapbook, Winter Music, won the Tree Chapbook Contest 2013. Her first collection of poetry, The Landscape That Isn't There, was shortlisted for the Archibald Lampman Prize 2019. Her second full collection, Airplane Earth, was published by Silver Bow Publications in 2024. She's married to poet Colin Morton, but does most of her poetry workshopping with the Ottawa group, the Ruby Tuesdays. Her poetry is marked by a strong narrative impulse and clear, accessible language. She writes on a range of subjects, moving between cultural landmarks and apocalyptic ruins, accompanied by fictional heroes, historical villains, strong women, and a family's steady presence. That, I believe, was the cover blurb on Airplane Earth.
Yeah,
so,
I just took it off the
bat. Yeah, that's all good. Let's welcome her.
Well, in response to popular demand, we were just talking about genealogical research. My husband Colin got really interested in it and was looking for our common ancestors, because we're bound to have them, we're white people, and he did find one. So I've written this poem about several of my ancestors, starting with the one that we have in common. It's called These Hard Stones. They moved a lot, my settler ancestors, from England to New England, Ontario to Michigan to North Dakota, from North Dakota to Alberta. Most often the last thing they did was settle. In Rhode Island, there is a stone cairn called Nine Men's Misery, where survivors of the Great Swamp Battle were undone by the Narragansett. My ancestor, Captain Pierce, led those troops into the swamp, but did not lead them out. He is settled somewhere near. In North Dakota, I stood beside a field and contemplated the boulder where Samantha's homestead shack stood, the 8x12 cabin in which she endured her husband, her dying baby, her own consumption. My great-grandmother is settled in a grave under the waters of the Ashtabula Dam. My cousin shows me a box full of arrowheads her father picked from our grandparents' fields when they first were plowed. How he must have treasured them to keep them in this tin tobacco box, still with us after a century. An archaeologist might have deciphered them, judged by the scatter whether they were the remains of a hunt or a battle. We can only note that they were made by people with small hands and sharp eyes, that they were used and lost. And this next one got the greatest rejection letter I've ever had from Rattle Magazine. It made it to the third reading, and they apologized, saying they get 30,000 poems and they can only take 40, but good luck. Thank you, Rattle. So this is called Carpe, as in Carpe Diem. But I want the kind of day I had yesterday. Newspaper on the deck, coffee at my elbow, three square meals, a game of Scrabble, a few hours with a good book. I don't want a day where I load my car with laptop, meds, water, and pets, and drive one narrowed lane through smoke and fire. I don't want a day when I step over skeletons to climb the Darien Gap, or one where I pay hard cash to straddle a dinghy heaving across the Hellespont. I want to deadhead my geraniums, make pesto in the blender, laugh at a meme of the Statue of Liberty holding aloft a cat. I don't want the day when I take my son to the hospital and the doctor says he has a chance, and I return an hour later and the doctor is gone, My son is gone. The hospital is gone. Don't seize that day. Yeah. And this is this last one. These are the unpublished poems. I'm starting with my three gloomy ones. This is wildlife photo of the year. I just stumbled upon this photograph while scrolling through David Attenborough. He really let me down. Wildlife photo of the year. A leopard strides toward the camera, dangling from her mouth the limp body of a monkey, clinging to its fur, a baby monkey. Their expressions, green ruthlessness, bleak despair. It knows something's wrong, but not what or what to do. Inert in the orange creature's jaws. Oh, we know what that's like. And I'm going to read a few from Airplane Earth. I didn't time these, Bruce, so please just tell me when my time's up and I'll quit. But this is another one I've never read in public, but since I'm on current events, coming from Ottawa, I, of course, lived through the convoy occupation. And this is called We Are Occupied by Freedom, Ottawa, 2022. 3001. Our streets are clogged. Our vocabulary's updated. It's not asshat or a-hole. It's air horn. A Pied Piper brought them to town. In the Middle Ages, people killed the dogs and cats that killed the rats. Now they're anti-vax. Freedom for some is prison for others. I do not leave the house. 102. I wake to the sound of heavy machines. First thought, armored personnel carrier. No, it's just a snowplow. 702. The politicians debate. Is occupation a federal, provincial, or municipal responsibility? 902. The honking continues. Driving makes me nervous. Which laws will that truck obey? 1802. Switch channels between figure skating and police action. Perfect choreography. No tasers or truncheons. No flamethrowers on the horses. 2102. The bouncy castle is deflated. The hot tub is drained. Signs threatening the Prime Minister with sexual violence are gone. We clean up. Count the cost. Peace, trust, friendships broken. We call it the craziness, as if a name could make it abnormal. And to give you a break, one of the things I like to do is visit museums. So there's a sequence of poems in this book of various museum visits that I've had different times. This one dates actually from 2015 when I was in England at the British Museum. When it rains, they pour through the museum doors. Crowds admire all this archaeology, treasure buried when the invaders were near, helmets and swords from Saxon graves. We pause before the Parthenon marbles, stand behind the masses at the Rosetta Stone, grab selfies by Assyrian gates. Too tired to talk about plunder, we find one place in perfect peace, the Hall of Islamic Art. Alone, we look at tiles and carpets, trace curving cursive letters. Crusaders admired these designs and brought home cloth embroidered with Arabic words. Renaissance painters wrapped them round the Virgin Mary. In oils today, we see Virgin and Child bordered by Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. The next new thing. In their exhibit at the Glenbow, the Niitsitapi tell us it was 1700 when they first saw the animal called Ponoka Omita'a, elk dog. Big as an elk, it pulled and carried like a dog. When Lewis and Clark met them 100 years later, the horse was more than dog or elk. It was riches and war, buffalo hunt and bride price. 100 years ago, horsepower was everything. Plows or carriages, nothing moved without a Clydesdale or a pony. The new thing was automobile. It moves itself. We thought it would make us free. Okay. And of course, the Louvre. Who could write about museums without writing about the Louvre? This is called Floodplain. The elevator at the apartment in the Marais is too small for us and our suitcases, so I ride up with the baggage while my husband takes the stairs. The room has a bed in one corner and a TV at its foot, stove and sink behind a counter, bathroom tucked behind that. The owners left a sliver of soap in the shower, a damp rag in the sink. On the tiny TV, floodwaters are spreading across Calgary, the part everyone used to call the floodplain, and the subtitled mayor of my old hometown is saying, "Do not canoe on the river now, are you crazy?" But Paris is waiting. We want to go out and plot a footpath to the Louvre through the floodplain of the Seine. We walk with GPS on a tablet, but no paper map. And each time I touch our route, the image jumps. One more? I will read one from the pandemic. And this is the last one. This is called Subtext, Day 500 or so. We watched the Swedish movie, the one about the marriage, and the subtitles ran continuously even when the characters weren't speaking. We didn't notice right away that words and actions were out of sync, since that's what the movie was really about. But by the end, when the embrace at the door was subtitled, "I always hated your smug, oily smile," and the welcome drink, "Send an ambulance right away," by then we knew something was wrong. But it was so right for that movie, and we were so stoned, more merry than stunned. We watched the last half hour with no subtitles and understood everything, as if the script was written for us. Thank you very much.
Up next, Brendan Wiley, or simply Wiley to most, is a writer and woodworker from Joyceville. As a kid, he struggled with dyslexia and stayed as far away as he could from the literary world. These days, he finds comfort in the written word, whether it's his own or the works of his literary idols. For Wiley, writing isn't just about self-expression, it's a way to listen to. Let's bring up Brendan.
Hello. Haven't been writing as much or at all some days. It just seems to be continuously there's more and more to do, especially as the summer comes on. So I don't know if everyone else is like that, but yeah, this definitely gave me an opportunity to actually try to sit down and think about what I wanted to write about and talk about. So some of these poems are older, some of these I've worked on many times. This first one is called Cowpoke. It's about it's about a lot of things, but it's based on a song by the same name. So I ain't never been branded, and I'll never be broke. I'm a wild cowboy, a carefree cowpoke. I've never seen the prairies or the mountains out west. Joyceville is my home. It's the place I know best. I'm worn out like my boots and the jeans that I wear and the road that I drive. But I don't really care. Some days I feel rich, even though I'm broke. But I'm a wild cowboy, carefree cowpoke. This next one, it's a little cliche, but I wrote it pretty much in one take. I normally don't write things in one take. It's normally like over a series of days and all that. I wrote this at lunch, and I gave this to my cousin's fiance after my cousin had recently just passed away unexpectedly. So this poem is called Fire. So, love is a fire whose flames ignite in us such lofty hopes and dreams. It is the light that can, illuminate the depths of our very soul with rays shining bright even on the darkest of days. But love can also burn you, leave you feeling hollow and alone. It can set ablaze all those hopes and dreams, leaving behind a wreckage of ash and smoke. Love can bring you just as much joy as it can sorrow. But we need love in our lives. There is no life without it. And if you feel you have lost it, don't worry. Its embers remain. So love deeply, for it is the fire that warms us and guides our way. This next poem, this next poem is called Too Busy. As I said, I'm always too busy, especially as the summer comes. I've got gardening, woodworking, this, that. This always seems to be something. This poem's called Too Busy. I'm too busy. That's something I say a lot. As I fall behind on my to-do list, a list that never ends. It grows and grows, little by little, until it becomes an oak tree. And bit by bit, it still grows, continuing to grow until something, into something that is so big it would take 100 lumberjacks a lifetime to chop down. But why? Why do I keep saying yes, forever adding new tasks to my list? Why don't I grow a backbone and tell everyone I'm just too busy? That I've already have too much on my plate? Just say no. I put off and put off things until my goals for the future become so distant in the rear view that I can hardly see them at all. No, I'm done, I tell myself. Done being busy and putting things off. When I live on my own, then my time will truly be my own. Ha! If only that were true. Time is never our own. We simply borrow it. And when our debts are due, we die and wish for more. This next poem is on writing. I don't know if you guys are feeling the same way, but I don't really enjoy writing. I enjoy the afterward part, like the editing, the changing, the tweaking, the finding the just the... So this poem is kind of about that. I don't enjoy writing. I enjoy having written. When I'm done and it's... and the words are on the page, free from my mind trying to make sense of it all. As my pen empties, so too does my mind of all worries and concerns. The tidal wave of thoughts begins to all trickle down into a gentle stream. But writing down isn't always easy. If I don't get the words right, the voices in my head grow louder and louder. And much like a new mother learning what her baby wants by the sound of each cry, so too am I trying to make sense of all of this. I often wish that my words were less melancholy, that I could use more playful diction, verse, and meter. But grace is not my forte. Perhaps that is for the best. For as the saying goes, true words are rarely beautiful, and beautiful words are rarely true. And this last poem I've written many, many times. This is version 16 of it. I think when you guys talked about revision, I have this quote, and I can never remember who it's by, but it's that poem is never truly done, only abandoned, which I think is true, that you just kind of... And sometimes I have poems that I really like, and I just get so sick of them that I just cast them off. And this is one that I've been working on for years and years and years. I actually had, through the suggestion of my sister, expanding it from just talking about my mom to talking about the other three important women in my life. So this goes over them, so all four of them. It's called A Smile. I wish I could smile and be happy, if not for my own sake, then for hers, so my mom could see me smile, because then maybe she would smile too. I wish I could laugh a real, honest, genuine laugh and be the life of the party instead of burying how I feel deep down inside. I know my friend can see it in my eyes, the pain and self-torment that follows me like my own shadow. I hate hiding things from her. Sometimes I worry I'm dragging her down with me. I wish I could be happy. Things would be better if only I were more cheerful, because then my sister could stop worrying and being so anxious. She often worries about me, calling or texting, checking in to see how I'm doing. I wish she didn't have to. Even as a kid, she took care of me. Just once, I'd like to be there for her for a change, instead of being such a burden. I wish I could be carefree, that I could goof around and play all day long, instead of dreading my entire small, meaningless life. I worry that my niece can see how broken I truly am, how jaded I've become. Sometimes I get so tired that I just start falling apart. On those days, I'm afraid that she is seeing so much of the sullen side of life. When she's older, she'll have enough troubles of her own. For now, I just want her to enjoy being a kid, and I think I'm ruining that for her. I wish I could smile and be happy, if not for my own sake, then for theirs, so they could all see me smile, because then they would smile too. And that's it.
And up next, Cullen Morton, writer, editor, performer, teacher, reviewer, poet. Cullen Morton lives in Ottawa, a winner of local and national awards. He has published a dozen books, including his most recent, Scar Atlas. And I think you're reading out of that today, aren't you? So let's bring up Cullen.
Thanks, Bruce. When I was here last year, I was going over the proofs of Scar Atlas. I didn't have the book. Now I have the book, and I'm going to read three poems from it. When I was in my teens, I had a column in the high school newspaper called The Listening Post. And I think listening is an important part of writing poetry, and I find that in these three poems I've ended in a similar fashion by quoting someone. I've been listening to them. This is the title poem from Scar Atlas. It's kind of sets the tone for the book. It's Scar Atlas. My father leaned over the sink to study his face in the mirror. With a sterilized needle, he probed, prodded, nudged out a sliver of bomb casing, risen to the surface years after he came home from war. Field doctors had removed the larger bits, phosphorus that glowed in the dark, then smoothed on a sheet of skin borrowed from his body lower down, and when the patient regained his sight, sent him back to the battle. As he lay on the sofa watching TV, his legs across my lap, I traced a route with my fingers on the map of shrapnel scars that pitted his shins. He watched in silence, scenes of war staged as heroics on the screen. Never spoke of his wounds, said only that the scars no longer hurt. This one is for a friend back in Calgary. It's called Late Call. We'd get together on my rare trips home, beer and tacos, hammocks in his backyard, telling tales of the 60s and 70s when anywhere, away, was our motto, and he really lived it. While I got my degrees, I was waiting for letters from Kathmandu or Merida. I know I'll have to work till I die, he'd say, but I'm glad I lived my 20s free. Though I remember him at 20, too, crying on the floor for his mother lost, father AWOL. Though he trekked from Damascus to Rajasthan, he never shook free the grudge he carried that later, baffling doctors, settled to his gut. Life goes on, he'd say, and then it won't. One last call, when not enough is said besides goodbye. You came to help, I remind him. When my car dropped its axle after midnight and I woke you with my call. Not this time, friend, he faintly laughs. From now on, you're on your own. And this third one has to do with one of the ailments, the complaints that we gather as we age. It's called tinnitus. You might have heard it. John Cage, the composer, said that if you go into a silent room, you hear two things. The thump of your blood and the hiss of your nervous system. So I read John Cage and in a silent room listened to the low thrum of blood in my veins, the hiss of nerves in my head. Proprioception, I called it, after Charles Olson. For years, I believed what I heard was the microbiome of my inner ear, cells living out their lives in there. And I wondered about this thing called me. How much of me is a population of microbes doing I don't know what to or for me, living and dying as I say these words? Now I accent the first syllable, call it tinnitus, as if that's an explanation. I told the doctor, I guess there's little I can do. You can complain, he said. Now I'm going to read some other poems, and I guess apologies to any philosophers in the tent. When I talk about the trolley problem, you might know about the trolley problem. In the general descriptions, people are tied to the tracks, but in my poem, the people are able to help each other get untied. Philosophers don't spend all their time mincing words. Many are proficient at party games. In the one known as the trolley problem, play can be deadly. All players face the same challenge. You're a passenger on a runaway trolley car speeding toward a split in the track. Several people stand on the track ahead where they are certain to be struck and killed unless you pull a lever to divert the trolley onto a sidetrack. There, unfortunately, one person will be killed, but only one. Players have stumbled into the field of ethics, and there is no easy way out. If they pull the lever, they will be directly responsible for the death of a fellow human. If they do not pull the lever, several people they could have saved will die. The math appears simple. Act and save lives by killing, or stand by and watch a disaster. Should it matter who is on the track ahead? Would it be morally different if your child was on one of the tracks? Or your abuser? Ethics is not zero sum. Outside the game, consequences are uncertain. Who can say the lever you won't jam when you pull it? Or even derail the car, spilling passengers onto the street? What then? The trolley problem does not say. Perhaps the people on the track will see the trolley crash and rush to help the injured. That is the moral choice we put our faith in. And since philosophers just think they never retire, philosophers never retire. Socrates, awaiting execution, decided to versify Aesop's fables. True. Euclid, in retirement, organized his books by shape and size. Don't know about that one. Plato got involved in politics and was jailed in a cave. Archimedes haunted the baths. Sisyphus, reaching the top of his hill, saw steeper, higher hills beyond and withdrew to the seaside to watch the waves roll in. I guess he wasn't a real philosopher. Of course, we know about all those philosophers from their books. And this is kind of a tribute to a bookstore. Well, what used to be a bookstore? It's Hillhurst Books. Here, I crossed deserts, scaled mountains, breached the walls of Troy, standing at the $5 shelf, boots leaking melted snow into the creaking floorboards. Here I found Howl, marked 10 cents in red across the front. Two Homers, earmarked, in rival translations. Paperback novels in lurid covers. Epics with a whiff of the cellar ranked like ramparts near the ceiling. The owner didn't mind how long you stood and read. The only rule was no smoking. Everything but that has changed. Go through the door today and read A Lexicon of Coffee Treats. Find a booth with a charger, log on and browse the substacks a while before getting to work. A couple of pieces in the city. Downtown summer, very descriptive. At noon, office workers line up at food trucks. Girls in summer dresses ripple like water across the street. Couriers in spandex zigzag through traffic, slapping fenders of cars that coast through red lights. Sprawled on the pavement, an old guy, maybe young, holds out his hand for change. A loony flies his way and he calls, "God bless you." This is about a woman in the city and the men she knew. She worked in the poorhouse. Slave wages cost tips. Wrote a novel called Trinket about the men she knew. One who never kicked her unless she was down. One who kicked back to the cops on the beat. One she never got to kick at all. And one who sold her a promise of paradise, gave her a ring that fit like a noose. And something a bit cheerier. But still summer, closing the cabin. Last morning at the lake, we sweep the cabin clean, load the boat, cast off. With motor low, we round the point and steer for the shore where we left our car. Off the last cape, at the family of loons who dove away from us all summer, fly in low above our heads. Voicing a salute, we say. Or are they glad to see us go? I'll go in a minute with these last two poems. This is called poem called Grateful. And in this one, I was inspired by Maureen Hines' poem called Poem Called Grateful. And she wrote her poem after another poet's poem, which was called Grateful. So this is a poem called Grateful. Maureen Hines' poem starts, "Could you write one too?" I took it as a challenge. And I begin my poem, "Would you write one too? Pampered on the patio of Banff Springs Hotel, give thanks for the peace and calm witness of mountains. Would you maintain a respectful silence before monuments to looters of the land you've grown to love? Would you toss your tokens of resentment in the Bow, St. Lawrence, or any river, paint graffiti under bridges, search landfills for signs of remorse, slag heaps for troves of rare earth? One sunny day in January, Christmas trees line up in drifts awaiting a new birth, new gifts to burgeon from the icy ground. Is it enough to return them, you wonder? Or could you write a poem called Grateful?" And the last poem, again, is a poem about writing poems. And it's holding out for a different kind of poem than I've actually been reading. This one's called Nocturne. Wind in the branches, whispering waves. How much of our poetry is staging the abalone bed for a single small pearl found on a petal or a rainy street, on the crest of a breaker or the eye saw in the beak of a in the crest of a breaker, in the beak of a raptor, in the depths of the sea, or the eye socket of a skull? If you could see its gleam without the setting, you'd be left without a poem to learn. It would turn in your mind like a moon. And thanks everyone for listening.
Now the four of them, Bruce, Mary Lee, Colin, Brendan, another hand.
And again from the, let me adjust my mic here a little bit. Again from the 2025 Poets at Art Fest, Outdoor Poetry Festival, you heard in this hour readings by Bruce Cudmore, Mary Lee Bragg, Brendan Wiley, and Colin Martin. And again, out there, my heartfelt thanks to all of you for tuning in to this second hour, and maybe even the first hour if you're listening then. An equal thanks to all the poets who participated that I aired today, and I'm going to go ahead and run those names off. David Malone, Jason Haru, Allison Chisholm, Michael E. Castiles, Carolyn Smart, and again, the ones you just heard, Bruce Cudmore, Mary Lee Bragg, Brendan Wiley, and Colin Martin, for their wonderful poetry readings this year. Excuse me. And to all of the other people, guests who came out to support and listen to the events. So my heartfelt thanks to, again, not only you listening out there, but all of those who took part so that you had something to hear. How's that? It is 54 minutes after 5 o'clock, and I'm going to begin to start to slide out of here. I will sort of do my standard few words to end the hour, and then I do have several because I didn't air any in the first hour. Excuse me, just a second. I do have several recorded announcements to air to take us to the top of the hour. Excuse me, I have this sneezing thing going on here, and I don't want to do that on air, so if I break from time to time, that's why. Anyway, you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We're located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6. Quick reminder, both hours, I upload both hours of this show each week to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on CFRC. .wordpress.com. They will remain there for 3 years. Again, my heartfelt thanks for tuning in today. Right now, I'd encourage you to stay tuned to 2 hours of East Coast music and a show called Saltwater Music coming up right after these announcements. And I'll catch you here next week. Have a great one.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could borrow a musical instrument free of charge, just like you can borrow books from your local library? We think so too. That's why the Joe Chitlin Memorial Musical Instrument Lending Library, also known as Joe's Mill, has been lending guitars, keyboards, saxophones, and many other instruments to the Kingston community free of charge for almost 20 years. We are a registered charity, relying solely on the generosity of our community to donate their time, money, and instruments to keep this amazing service alive. Find us at www.joesmill.org or Joe's Mill on Facebook for more information on borrowing instruments or contributing to Joe's Mill.
Weekly Writing Spark on CFRC 101.9. Join your host, Ara McCauley, for a free-flow show where words, ideas, and music mingle. Each week, we sit down with one of the local authors and artists leading writing workshops through the Word Labs program. They'll share their stories, their insights, maybe even a few secrets of their craft. Get your pens ready. After the chat, you'll get writing prompts to stretch your imagination, all set to a soundscape designed to help you focus, relax, and create.
Your library, your story. At the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, books are just the beginning. A library card starts a lifelong adventure, connecting you to everything you need to inspire learning, creativity, and fun. With 16 locations and plenty of online services, using your library has never been easier. Study in a quiet space, meet friends and learn new things, or explore the world through a magazine or a museum pass. Become a part of our story. Visit your local library branch or find us online at kfpl.ca.
Tune in Sundays at 11 p.m. for Orchestral Maneuvers After Dark with me, DJ Squared. Each episode features a great mix of new and vintage, Canadian and international, new wave, punk, post-punk, garage rock, pop, electronica, ambient, and even the occasional remix. Sweet beats are in store for all to enjoy. Join in the fun, OMD, every Sunday at 11 right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.